Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this special lecture here in Woolston College. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies in the University and a member of this college. So just before I introduce our speaker, I'll say a word about the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is the sponsoring body for this lecture and many other activities associated with law, justice and society. The Foundation is an independent institution associated with Woolston College and with the University through the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. Our task, our mission, is to increase awareness and understanding and discussion of issues of law, justice and society, and to try to make the fruits of academic research more easily accessible to a wider audience. And we've been going for 10 years so far. If you want to look at our website, fljs.org, you'll see that we have a wide range of interesting issues that have been discussed over the last 10 years. We hope we'll be continuing for another 10 years. Well, our speaker tonight, for this special lecture, is rather unusual in a sense. Mr. Bill Browder will be well known to some of you, but perhaps not to all. But this book called Red Notices, How I Became Putin's Number One Enemy, has just been published. Many of you will have seen it. It's available in Blackwell's. The intriguing question is that, given that Mr. Putin probably has quite a lot of enemies, how Bill became enemy number one. So, Bill, we look forward to hearing a detailed account of how you achieved this particular distinction. Or perhaps some would not describe it as distinction, but anyhow, we look forward to hearing from it. I won't speak at length in introducing our speaker more. He will give you quite a full account of his background and particularly of the events which have led to the publication of this book. But I will just say that he was a very successful founder and chief executive officer of Hermitage Capital Management, which for some years was the largest foreign investor in Russia. So if anybody knows what goes on in the financial world and the political world of Russia, I imagine Bill does. So Bill, without more ado, I'm going to hand over to you. Bill will speak for about 50 minutes and then there'll be plenty of time for your questions and discussion. Thank you very much.
Well, when you hear the first words out of my mouth with my American accent, you're probably doubly wondering how it is that this guy with an American accent ended up becoming Putin's number one enemy. And so I'd like to start at the beginning to tell you my story, and I think you will. This is not going to be your typical academic lecture. This is more like a Bourne Identity movie without the visuals. So I am indeed American. I was born in Princeton, New Jersey. I grew up in Chicago, but I come from a very unusual American family. My grandfather, Earl Browder, was from Wichita, Kansas, and he was a labor union organizer. And during the 1920s, he was so good at organizing the union that he went from Wichita to Kansas City, and from Kansas City eventually to New York City. And in New York City, there was a lot of different characters running around, including some people from an organization called Comintern, which is Communist International. And they approached my grandfather and they said, if you like labor unionism, you're going to love communism. Why don't you come to Moscow to check it out? And so in 1927, my grandfather, Earl Browder, moved to Moscow. When he got there, he did what most young American men did then and do now, which is he found himself a Russian girl who became my grandmother. And then my father was born there, and he had two brothers. And then 5 years later, Earl Browder was tapped on the shoulder by the International Communist Party to go back to America and to become the head of the American Communist Party. So he gets back to America in 1932. He runs for president in 1936 and 1940 against Roosevelt on the communist ticket. He was imprisoned in 1941, eventually pardoned by Roosevelt in 1942. And then he was kicked out of the Communist Party in 1945 for being too much of a capitalist. But being kicked out of the Communist Party for being too much of a capitalist didn't prevent him from being persecuted by Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s for being a communist. So this is my family legacy. I was born in 1964. I'm 51 years old. And when in the 1970s, when I was going through my teenage rebellion, I was trying to figure out a way that I could upset my family. And so I tried I first tried growing my hair long, and it didn't grow long, it grew wide, and I ended up with an afro. That didn't upset my family, strangely. Although my father does blame my current hairstyle on my afro. I followed the Grateful Dead around the country for a brief period of time, and strangely, that didn't upset my family either. But what did upset them, and it really worked beautifully, was when I put on a suit and tie and declared myself a capitalist. That really upset my parents a lot. So I became a capitalist, and I eventually enrolled at Stanford Business School. At business school, I started to try to figure out what I was going to do post-business school. And one of the things that I learned very quickly on was all the normal on-campus recruiting that was being done at Stanford, none of it really resonated with me. I somehow couldn't feel like I wanted to do the normal things that were being recruited for on campus. And I was graduating business school in 1989, and as many of you will remember, 1989 was the year that the Berlin Wall came down. And so as I was struggling to figure out what I could do with my life and to do with my job, I had this epiphany one day, which is, if my grandfather was the biggest communist in America, I'm going to go out and become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. And so that's what I set out to do. Now, there was nothing going on in capitalism in Eastern Europe at the time, and so I ended up moving to London, where I settled, and I got a job with the American consulting firm, the Boston Consulting Group. And I said to them, I want to be your Eastern European guy. And they said, great, if we ever have any work in Eastern Europe, you will be our Eastern European guy. And they sent me out to do sort of normal things that young consultants do. And then one day, about 6 months into it, there was a knock on my door, and it was the head of the office, and said, you were the guy who wanted to do Eastern Europe, right? And I said, yeah, that's me. And he said, well, we've got something for you. And the Boston Consulting Group had been hired by the World Bank to advise the Polish government on a failing bus factory in the southeast corner of Poland. And the amount of money that they were being paid, the Boston Consulting Group were being paid by the World Bank, was just a very small sum of money. And so the only person that BCG could afford to send was a first year associate. So I go out to this town called Sanok, which was about 7 hours from Warsaw on the Ukrainian border, where they produce these buses, as this, And they were kind of expecting me to be the local hero that was going to save their town from destruction. So I get out to this little town, and I discover something very demoralizing for this project, which is that the bus company only had one customer, which was the state of Poland, the government of Poland. And the government of Poland, because they had run out of money, stopped ordering buses. And so basically, if you lose 100% of your sales, it doesn't really leave you with much of an opportunity. And on top of that, their buses were terrible. It wasn't like you could find some other customers for these bad buses. And so the major part of my assignment was to basically go around all the different departments of this bus company and make a list of people who should be fired, which was pretty terrible, since this was a one company town, and everybody was effectively going to be put out of work. And so it was a very unpleasant, demoralizing assignment, and I was going around, and I had this one guy with me. His name was Leszek. He was my translator. And Leszek was going around with me as I was interviewing each of the departments to figure out how to make the list of people to be fired. And one day I noticed under Leszek's arm, he had a newspaper, and on the front of the newspaper, there was a number of financial figures. And I said, Leszek, what are those financial figures? And he's got very excited and he started smiling and said, these are the very first privatizations in Poland. And I was kind of interested. And so I said, well, that's interesting. Can you explain it to me? And so we sat down in the conference room and he laid out the newspaper on the table. And I said, what does this number say right here? And he said, that's the number of shares outstanding of this company. And I said, and then right below it, I said, what's this number? He said, that's the share price that the government is selling the shares. And so I did the math, the share price times the number of shares outstanding got you to $80 million. And I said, what's this number right here down below? He said, that's last year's profits. I said, no, translate it for me exactly, because it couldn't be. He said, last year's profits. And I said, are you sure? He said, yeah, I'm sure. No, that number was $160 million. So you don't have to be a Stanford MBA to know that if a company has got a value of $80 million and the profits in the previous year was $160 million, that's probably a good investment opportunity. And so I thought about this for a couple days afterwards. I thought, okay, this is what you go to business school for, isn't it? To like find opportunities like this and do something about it. And so I took my life savings and decided to go all in on these Polish privatizations. I should point out that my life savings at the time was $2,000. We went and converted it to Polish zloty, and then I went to the post office, Leszek and I, and helped me fill out the forms, and I became a subscriber for the very first privatizations in Eastern Europe, in Poland. And amazingly, a year later, my investments had gone up 10 times. Now, my $2,000 had turned into $20,000. Now, I don't know how many of you in this room have ever had an investment go up 10 times, but if you have, you'll know that it releases a certain chemical in your stomach. And you want to have that feeling again and again. And so I hated consulting, because consulting, at least in my mind, was all about firing people, and I never wanted to do that again. But I love the idea of buying really cheap assets and having them go up 10 times. That really seemed like a good professional direction to go in. And so so I knew what I wanted to do with my life. So if we fast forward a couple of years, I end up at Salomon Brothers, which was a U.S. investment bank. It doesn't exist anymore today, but some of the people in this room will remember that company. There's a famous book written by Michael Lewis called Liar's Poker. If you haven't read it, no matter what your field is, you should probably read it, because it's a classic book about Wall Street and so on. And Salomon Brothers, which was described in Michael Lewis's book, was this sort of dog-eat-dog, the sort of epitome of Wall Street firm. And they hired me as an investment banker, and I showed up there, and my very first assignment at Salomon Brothers was to advise a fishing company in Murmansk in Russia on their privatization. The government of Russia, the management of the company had the right to purchase 51% of this fishing fleet from the government during the privatization program, and they wanted some advice. And again, it was a very, very small fee. And so I was a junior, very junior banker, but they sent me up to Murmansk. And so I get to Murmansk, and the head of the fishing fleet meets me at the airport. And the first stop before taking me to my hotel was to take me to the docks so I could visit one of their fishing, their trawlers, one of their vessels. So we get to the port, and I look, and he takes me to this vessel. And it's about 300 feet long. And on the top deck, they have all the nets where they bring the fish on board. And then they take all the stuff out of the nets, whether it's fish or other stuff, and send it down to the middle level where they separate the fish from all the seaweed and other stuff they pick up in their nets. And then at the bottom level, they then put those fish into cans. And it's effectively, the ship was like an ocean-going factory. And it was very impressive looking. And I said, how much does one of these things cost? And he said, these cost $20 million new. I said, how many do you have? And he said, there's 100 of them in our fleet. So I did the math. 20 million times 100 gets you to $2 billion worth of ships. And it looked, the ship wasn't particularly nice looking or nice smelling. And I said, well, what's the age of the fleet? And he said, it's about 7 years old. So I did the mental math and I figured 7 years old, $2 billion worth of ships, it's probably half depreciated. So their fleet is probably worth $1 billion. And then I said, okay, so the you want to know whether you should exercise your right under the privatization program to buy this 51% from the government. What is the price at which the government is selling 51% of this company for? And he said, $2.5 million. So just to repeat, there's $1 billion worth of ships, and they can buy 51% for $2.5 million. Well, it wasn't a very hard advisory assignment. The answer was yes. But I sat there and thought to myself, you know, I had this chemical feeling in my stomach again that, you know, if stuff was cheap in Poland, this is much cheaper than Poland was. And I should really not be in doing this nonsense advisory work. I should be buying this stuff for myself. And so I wanted to understand whether this was a some kind of fishing anomaly or whether this was something going on more in a more widespread basis in Russia. And so I, instead of going back to London, I got on a plane to Moscow to do some investigation into the whole privatization program. And I should point out that I don't speak a word of Russian, and I didn't know a soul in Russia. I get on a plane to Moscow, I arrive in Moscow, and as I'm going through Sheremetyevo Airport, I notice in a kiosk that they're selling a very thin English language yellow page directory. And so I decide to buy it as my first lead into how I'm going to figure this stuff out. And I get this English language directory. I go to the Metropole Hotel on Red Square, and I wake up the next morning and I start going through the directory and looking for any name that of any business that might know something about privatization, and I call them up and ask for a meeting. And I was able to get about 40 meetings. And by the end of the week, I discovered that this wasn't some kind of special anomaly in fishing, that the Russian privatization program was the single most compelling investment opportunity that's ever existed in history and probably ever will exist in the future. And what I discovered principally was something called the voucher privatization scheme. And basically, when Russia was going from communism to capitalism, they decided the best way to do this was to create a whole country full of capitalists. And the best way of creating a country full of capitalists was to give them property. And so the government gave away something called a voucher to every person in the country. And at the time, there was 150 million people living in Russia. And so they gave away 150 million of these privatization vouchers. And the vouchers were these freely tradable instruments. You got your voucher and you could give it to somebody, you could swap it for a bottle of vodka, you could sell it. And as a result, and there was no restrictions, you could be a foreigner, you could be a local person that was not registered anywhere, it was like a piece of currency. And these vouchers began to trade on a secondary market, and they sold for about $20 each. And so again, I did the math, $20 per voucher times 150 million vouchers in circulation gets you to $3 billion worth of vouchers. And these $3 billion worth of vouchers were exchangeable for 30% of all the share capital of all Russian companies, which meant that the market value of Russia for the whole country was $10 billion. Just to put this in some kind of context for you, Russia is a country that controls 35% of the world's natural gas, 10% of the world's oil, 10% of the world's aluminum, 10% of the world's steel. There's fertilizer, there's banks, there's car companies, there's telephone companies, there's electricity companies. The aggregate of everything for $10 billion. It was a 99.99% discount to everything else in the world. And so I was just completely blown away by this crazy thing that was going on. And so I fly back to London, and I'm sort of wild-eyed with enthusiasm. And I walk into Solomon Brothers, and I say, guys, we got to stop doing everything else we're doing. We've got to invest in Russia. And before I have a chance to even explain the math that I've just taken you through, the moment I said Russia, people said, what are you talking about, Bill? You know, I'm sorry, I'm too busy right now. And I didn't have a lot of internal political skills. So if somebody was rejecting me, I just went to the next person. And so I wasn't trying to figure out how I could sort of maneuver through the decision-making process of Solomon Brothers. And so I would just sort of bluntly and sort of stupidly go to anyone who would listen, tell them that we should be investing in Russia. The moment I mentioned Russia, they shut down. And as a result, I completely and absolutely discredited myself inside the company. I was this crazy guy talking about Russia. And so I was at the time about 29 years old. And I used to hang out with the other 29-year-old guys, and we would go for lunches together and drinks together. But when I got into this mess talking about Russia, all the invitations with the young guys stopped because nobody wanted to hang out with this crazy guy who all he could do was talk about Russia, because they didn't want to be tainted by my this weird stuff that I was doing. And Solomon Brothers was this incredibly dog-eat-dog place that if you weren't generating five times what they were paying you for the company, you were fired. And I was nowhere near generating five times what they paid me, or even one times what they were paying me. And on top of that, I was this crazy guy talking about Russia. And so I was certain that I was going to be fired. It was just a question of when, not if. And so and not only is it bad to be fired, but it was particularly bad when I had this vision of riches, and I could just see it right in front of my face in Russia, and I was being held back from doing it because these people were all like too close-minded. And I was sitting there sort of contemplating what I should do with myself and how I should, should I just stop this whole Russia thing and just like get back into mainstream and try to resurrect my career, or what should I do? And I was sitting at my desk one day and my phone rang. And it was a partner from the New York office of Solomon Brothers. And he said, Bill, I heard you have something interesting to say about Russia. I'd like to hear it. And I said, okay, great. And so we made an appointment that I was going to come in at the end of the week, so New York, and I was going to brief him on what was going on in Russia. So I spent the next couple of days putting together a PowerPoint presentation describing the math that I've just shared with you. And I'm very careful and meticulous and put it together in a very nice way and rehearse it and get it all in my mind how I'm going to present this so that I'm going to make a really clear, compelling case. So I get to New York. I go to this guy's office. I sit down. I start going through the PowerPoint presentation, and I get through about 20 pages of it. It's about a 40-page presentation, 20 minutes in, and this guy who I'm presenting to doesn't have normal social skills, and so he wasn't nodding his head and saying "uh-huh" after I was going through the slides. He was giving me no feedback that I could use to know whether I was getting through to him or not. And I was feeling a bit nervous, but just hoping that it was all going well. And 20 pages in, he abruptly stands up, turns around, walks out the door, and leaves me in the room by myself without any explanation. And this was my saving grace. This was going to be my life rope to not being fired, and he's just left. And I had thought that I had completely mastered this presentation. I'd rehearsed it in London. I'd rehearsed it on the plane. I'd gone through it over and over again, and I thought I really had gotten the message right, and I somehow hadn't, apparently, in my mind. And so I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to resurrect this meeting? How am I going to make it all get better? And I'm coming up with ideas in my head, and 5 minutes goes by, and this guy is still gone, and 10 minutes goes by, and he's gone, and I'm getting a little bit more anxious, wondering what he's up to, and 20 minutes, he's still gone, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, like 50 minutes later, he comes back into the room. And I'm at this point, I'm just ready to try to just do anything to resurrect this meeting. And before I have a chance to say a word, he says, Bill, what you showed me was the most compelling thing I've ever seen in my professional life. I just left and went to the risk management committee of Solomon Brothers, and I got you $25 million to invest in Russia. So I was just... All the black clouds who had been hanging over me had lifted. I go to Russia. I invest the $25 million. And then 7 months later, And this was at the end of 1993 that we got the money invested. 7 months later, The Economist magazine writes an article called Sale of the Century, in which they describe the same math that I shared with him and I've just shared with you about how cheap everything was in Russia. And as a result of that one article, the I don't know, 25 or 30 new people entered the market to buy these Russian stocks. And it was a highly thinly traded, illiquid market. And as a result of 25 people entering the market, our $25 million portfolio went up 5 times and turned into $125 million. And this was back in the days when $100 million of profit was real money. And so all of a sudden, I became a hero on the trading floor of Salomon Brothers. All the guys who had stopped inviting me for lunches and drinks were camped out at my desk when I arrived in the morning so that they could get investment advice on how to make 5 times their money in Russia. And then something really exciting and strange happened, which was all sorts of really the senior relationship managers for the company, the ones who dealt with the most important clients in the world, started to come around. And one guy came to my desk one day and said, Bill, I know you're real busy, but is there any chance you could spare some of your time to meet George Soros? He'd love to hear your story about Russia. And then another guy came by and said, Sir John Templeton would really be grateful if you could possibly, we know that you've got a lot of important stuff going on, but if you could possibly spend a little time with him. And then Julian Robertson, one of the most famous hedge fund managers, and Michael Steinhardt, and basically the entire royalty of Wall Street wanted to meet me to hear about how this young guy had made all this money in Russia. So I was 29 years old, and I said, yeah, of course I could go on these trips. And so I went on a world tour of famous investors from Wall Street. And I went to all these different places. And these people were not stupid like my colleagues at Salomon. At the moment that I went through my presentation, at the end of the meeting, they said, this is astounding. How do we get involved? Can we give you some money to manage? And at the time, we were just managing our own money. We weren't doing it for other people, and there's all sorts of rules and regulations about doing this. And so I said, I don't know. Let me go ask the bosses what the plan is, but I hope so. I'd love to manage money for you. So I go back to Salomon Brothers, and I go to the trading floor, I go to the boss of the trading floor, and I say, George Soros wants us to manage his money. Can we set up a business managing the money of George Soros and similar types of characters? And this guy said, that's a brilliant idea, Bill. Great idea. Let's form a task force to study it. So I was a little apprehensive, at the end of the week, it was the kickoff task force meeting. And so I come into this conference room, and it's a relatively small conference room, and it's completely packed with people. There's 45 people in the room, 40 of whom I've never seen before in my life. There was the vice chairman of Salomon Brothers, the several senior managing directors, senior directors, senior vice presidents, and me. And so the meeting got underway, and a fight broke out immediately. The one thing I can tell you is that investment bankers are extremely good at arguing for money that they're not entitled to. And so this argument broke out, and these incredibly articulate arguments. First, the emerging markets team said, we think we should get the money. And then the asset management group said, well, no, it's really an asset management product. And then the investment bank said, but he worked in the investment bank. And they're all making these great arguments, and I had no idea, and they're so persuasive, who was gonna win this fight. But I knew for sure who wasn't gonna get any economic credit for this business, and that was gonna be me. And so I really got very upset, and I decided I was gonna quit Salomon Brothers. So I quit Salomon Brothers in the summer of 1995. I moved to Moscow. I set up a company called Hermitage Capital Management, and I started doing it for myself. And I got one of the famous investors, a guy named Edmund Safra, to be my anchor investor. He put up the first $25 million of capital. And I got started investing in April of 1996 with something called the Hermitage Fund. And my timing couldn't have been better. I was investing just before the presidential election of 1996, where Yeltsin was running against Gennady Zhuganov. Gennady Zhuganov was a communist. Yeltsin had about a 4% approval rating going into the election. It looked like the communists were going to take over. The market was extremely depressed. And how are we doing on time, by the way? Are we okay?
Okay.
Okay. The market was extremely depressed, and we put our money in at just the right time. Over the next 18 months, my fund went up 850%. The assets went from $25 million to $1 billion. I was the best performing fund manager in the world in 1997. I was featured in the Financial Times and the New York Times and Time Magazine and Business Week as some kind of financial genius. My clients were sending their jets to take me to their yachts to celebrate my success. And this was all at the ripe age of 32. Now, any of these things would be nice accomplishments in their own right, but if you put them all together in the hands of a 32-year-old guy, in the parlance of Wall Street, that's the biggest sell signal there ever was. But of course, I didn't see the sell signal since I was 32 years old and didn't have any experience. And as many of you will remember, in 1998, the Russian government defaulted on their bonds. They devalued their currency by 75%. And the Hermitage Fund went from $1 billion to $100 million. We lost 90% of our money, lost $900 million. Now, if there's a certain chemical that gets released in your stomach when you make 10 times your money, there's a different chemical that gets released when you lose 90%. And it's not as nice a chemical. And so it was a terrible, terrible situation for me and everybody around me. And for me, the real tragedy of this whole story was that I convinced all these people to invest with me, to take the risk to come into Russia and invest with me, and many of them lost 90% of their money. And I was terribly mortified by that and humiliated. And so it became my obsession that I was going to find a way to get these people out of this hole. And in theory, it shouldn't have been that hard to do, because I own shares mostly of oil companies. And the oil companies were selling their oil in dollars. The oil is priced in dollars. And so their revenues, their sales stayed the same. But all of their costs, because they were in Russia, were in rubles. And the ruble had just devalued by 75%. So in theory, the costs are the same. The revenues are the same, the costs have just gone down, and so the profits should have exploded. And so in theory, if I just sat it out and waited it out, the value of these companies should have risen right back up. That was the theory. Unfortunately, the reality was that all of these companies were majority owned by these people known as the Russian oligarchs. The Russian oligarchs were 22 individuals who had effectively stolen 40% of the country during the privatization program. And these guys were the majority shareholders of these companies. And these people were not nice people to start out with. They're very, very aggressive, non-law-abiding people, to put it nicely. And one of the things that happened pre-1998, when I was first investing in these oil companies, was that as I was running around buying the shares of the oil companies, there were all these fancy investment bankers from New York who were also running around meeting the oligarchs. And they were saying to the oligarchs, "We think we can get you access to money on Wall Street." And the oligarchs said, "That sounds great. We like money." But the bankers said that, "But there's one condition, which is that you can't scandalize your minority shareholders, because no one will give you money otherwise." And so the oligarchs thought, "Well, hard not to scandalize, but steal from people, but we do like that idea of money." And so this incentive, this sort of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow of getting this money from Wall Street, kept them from stealing from the shareholders of these companies that I had invested in up until 1998. But after the default and devaluation of Russia, there was no longer, Wall Street had closed for business. When these guys called up their fancy bankers from Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, the guys on the other end of the phone said, "I'm sorry, who? And put the phone down, because you get fired for having done business in Russia if you worked at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And when it became clear to the oligarchs that there was no more Wall Street free money to be had, they said to themselves, well, if there's no longer an incentive to behave, and there's never been a disincentive to misbehaving, we might as well just steal everything. And so the oligarchs of Russia, at the end of 1998, going into 1999, embarked on an orgy of stealing which has been unprecedented in the history of business. They were doing asset stripping, transfer pricing, embezzlements, dilutions, every possible technique for stealing money from shareholders. They were doing it, and doing it on a massive industrial scale. And so there I was, sitting with my last 10 cents on the dollar. I'd already lost 90%, and they were effectively going to try to steal that last 10 cents from me. And so, as a matter of necessity, I had to become a shareholder activist in Russia. Now, being a shareholder activist in Russia is a lot different than being a shareholder activist in the West. The size of the problems are just enormous. And probably the biggest problem I ever had, and the biggest and the most famous case I ever had, involved a company called Gazprom, which I'm sure you've all heard of. Gazprom is the largest gas company in the world. In 1999, after the default and devaluation, Gazprom traded at a 99.7% discount to Exxon and BP per barrel of hydrocarbon reserves. Why was it so cheap? It was so cheap because everybody assumed that every last cubic meter of gas and oil that the company owned had been stolen out of it. And so I decided in my new capacity as a fighter against this stuff that I was going to do an analysis, a stealing analysis of Gazprom. I was going to figure out how much they really stole. So how do you do a stealing analysis of a Russian company? There was no course at Stanford Business School on this subject. I couldn't go to the management of the company and say, hello, sir, can you tell me how much you're stealing? Nor could I go to any of the specialist analysts at investment banks who covered these companies and ask them, because the banks were so busy trying to get advisory work from Gazprom, the last thing they'd ever want to do is be seen to be saying anything bad about the company. So I came up with this idea, which was, and I got this idea from being a management consultant. Management consultants, because my first job was in consulting, management consultants are hired by big companies to find answers to problems. And so what they go and do is they go and like make a list of people who actually know the answers and interview them. And so I said I should do that with the stealing at Gazprom. So I made a list of the people I thought who would know about the stealing. Ex-employees, competitors, customers, suppliers, government officials. And I made a list of these people, and I invited them to lunches and dinners and breakfasts and teas and coffees to see what they would tell me. And I didn't give them my agenda in advance. I just said, I want to have a meal with you. And they thought, how interesting, this foreign guy wants to have a meal with me. I'll see what he's got to say. So I go and have a meal with the first guy. And in my first meeting, I discover the most interesting cultural anomaly about Russia, or Russians, I should say, which was that during the Soviet times, the richest person in Russia was 6 times richer than the poorest person. You might have had a 4-room apartment instead of a 1-room apartment, and you might have had a driver and a car, and maybe a dacha if you were a Politburo member versus a worker. But it wasn't that dramatic. By 1999, 10 years later, the richest person in Russia was 250,000 times richer than the poorest person in Russia. So over 10 years, you have this spectacular disparity of wealth, which poisoned the psychology of the entire country. Everybody in Russia was just furious that they didn't get to participate in the stealing. There was a small group of people who were all getting all the money, and everybody else was living effectively in poverty. And so when I asked, at the first lunch, when I started talking about stealing at Gazprom, this guy who we were meeting with just started spilling his guts to me. It was like a catharsis for him to actually talk to someone about this. And I started taking notes and writing it all down, turning the page and taking some more notes. 2 hours later, he could have sat there all day. After 2 hours, I had to stop him. I had to go to another meeting. Every other meeting was exactly the same. We filled up 2 full notebooks full of these anecdotes about stealing at Gazprom. So It's fantastic information, shocking information that we got. The only problem was we had no idea if it was true. You know, you talk to people and they could be lying, sour grapes, exaggeration, who knows? And we didn't know what we could really do with this. I mean, it was really interesting and we had a lot of interesting discussions around the office, but what do we do with this information? And then about 3 weeks after our last interview, my head of research, a guy named Vadim, he's a PhD guy, very smart, he was driving through Moscow on his way to the office and he got to Pushkin Square. And Pushkin Square in Moscow is where the Boulevard Ring meets Tverskaya Boulevard, which is it sort of comes in at a T. And it's the most congested intersection in Moscow. And because it's so congested, you end up with a traffic jam almost eternally, other than in the middle of the night. And so the traffic jam during the day can last anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour. And so as a result of this traffic jam, some very industrious street urchin boys had set up an outdoor market where they sell stuff to cars that are stuck in the traffic jam. And they sell everything from cigarette lighters to pirated DVDs to women's underwear to all sorts of strange stuff that they're selling at these traffic lights. And some kid came up to Vadim's car and knocked on the window and he rolls down his window and he said, "What do you have?" And the kid says, "Databases." And he said, what do you mean databases? And he had this down parka and he opens up this down parka and he has these plastic folders with these disks in them. And he said, "Like, give me an example." He said, "Well, here I've got the Moscow Registration Chamber database, which shows the beneficial ownership of all Russian-based companies," which was one of the things we were desperate to get our hands on to prove this stealing. Vadim said, "How much?" "$5." He hands him the $5, he gets in the car, drives to the office, and he comes in the office and says, "Guess what, they're claiming they're selling the Moscow Registration Chamber database." And we say, "Yeah, right." And so let's check it out. So he puts it into the computer, and this is actually before the days of computer viruses where you can just stick a random disk in your computer. And sure enough, that's the Moscow Registration Chamber database with all the bells and whistles. And on the front of the database, there was a phone number to call for other databases. And by the way, he got ripped off for the $5. I think the other ones were like $3. And from those databases, we were able to piece together the most unbelievable economic analysis that's ever been done on anything. We were able to piece together and prove conclusively that the management of Gazprom, nine individuals between 1996 and 1999, had stolen oil and gas reserves the size of Kuwait out of Gazprom. And nobody knew it. The size of Kuwait. Now, if you remember, there was a war fought over oil and gas reserves the size of Kuwait in Kuwait. And nobody knew about this. So that was the first discovery. The second discovery was even more astounding from an investment standpoint, which was that oil and gas reserves the size of Kuwait only represented 9.65% of Gazprom's total reserves. So remember, the market has believes and has priced the stock at a 99.7% discount because the market believes that everything has been stolen out of the company. And we've just proven conclusively that more than 90% of the company is still there. Now, as an investor, what do you do with this type of information? Well, to use a very highly technical financial term, we backed up the truck and bought as much of the Gazprom stock as we could get our hands on. It became my single largest investment. And then we did something which most people don't do, which was I took the dossier that we had created and I broke it into seven chapters. And I gave the first chapter to the New York Times, the second chapter to the Financial Times, the third one to the Wall Street Journal, the fourth one to Business Week, to show them what was going on at Gazprom. And each of them wrote big stories. And on the back of their big stories, the Russian press picked it up. On the back of the Russian press picking it up, the Russian parliament then began debates about whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to have these assets stolen out of Gazprom. More stories on the back of those debates. Then the management of Gazprom hired a big four accounting firm to write a report that concluded that it was a good thing to have these assets taken out of the company. More stories. In the end, there are more than 500 stories written about the massive theft of Gazprom. And then something really totally unexpected and strange happened, which was that at the annual general meeting in 2001, Vladimir Putin, who had just recently become president, entered into the fray, and he fired the CEO of Gazprom, the guy who did the stealing, and he brought in a new guy whose job it was not to steal assets from the company. I stress the word assets because he's allowed to steal other stuff. But just making the announcement that he wasn't going to steal any assets from the company, the share price jumped 138% in one day. Then the share price doubled again. It doubled again after that, and then doubled again following that. In total, between 1999, when we started this whole campaign, and 2005, the share price of Gazprom went up 100 times. Not 100%, 100 times. And this was my single largest investment. Now, as you can imagine, I felt pretty good about that. And I decided I was going to repeat the exercise in the electricity company. And then I was going to repeat the same exercise in the National Savings Bank. And then I was going to repeat the same exercise in two oil companies. And then the same exercise in the oil pipeline company. And I discovered in this process that I had this unwitting ally in my fight against the oligarchs. Vladimir Putin, when he came to power, was fighting with the same guys I was fighting with. They were stealing power from him at the same time as they were stealing money from me. And so we ended up in this situation where I've never met Vladimir Putin in my life, never then and never since then. But we had this alignment of interest, and in Russia, your enemy's enemy is your friend. And so we, every time I would publicize one of these scandals, Putin or some minister in his government would step in and do something about it. And so people were fired, presidential decrees were issued, new laws were passed. And as a result of that, we didn't have the same unbelievable, elegant success that we had with Gazprom and everything, but we had a lot of success. And my $100 million of assets that I had at the bottom of the market slowly appreciated to $4.5 billion at the top of the market. And I became the single largest foreign investor in Russia. Now, it was all unbelievably great because not only was I making money for my clients, making money for myself, but I was also getting the bad guys and making Russia a better place. And there was nothing more satisfying than that. But it was too good to be true. And to enter into this kind of brazen sort of anti-corruption work, you can't be too sensitized to who might be mad at you. In fact, I kind of sanded off my risk sensors because you can't be sitting there looking at who's going to come after you and do what I was doing. And so my risk sensors weren't up very high when something really dramatic happened to change the chemistry of the whole situation, which was that at the end of 2003, Putin won his war with the oligarchs by arresting the richest oligarch in the country, a man named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is the owner of the Yukos oil company. So they arrest Mikhail Khodorkovsky on his jet in Siberia, and everybody assumed that he would be out of jail in a week at most, because if you have money, you can always get out of jail. A week went by and he wasn't out of jail. They assumed that he must not have paid a big enough bribe, and so it'll just be 2 weeks. And how stupid of him not to pay the right size bribe on the first go round. 2 weeks, he's still in jail. A month, 2 months. By the summer of 2004, he was still in jail, and they put him on trial for tax evasion. And in Russia, when you're on trial, there's in a criminal prosecution, there's a 99.5% conviction rate. And so they don't even bother with a presumption of innocence, and they stick all defendants in a cage as if you've already been convicted when you're on trial. And so in the summer of 2004, they put Mikhail Khodorkovsky on trial, and they allowed the television cameras to come into the courtroom and film the richest man in Russia sitting in a cage. Now, imagine, if you will, that you're the 17th richest man in Russia. It's the summer. So you're on your yacht. Your yacht is parked off the Hotel du Cap in Antibes, where they mostly congregate. And you've just finished up with your mistress in the bedroom, and you're on your way out to the living room to watch a little television. You flick on the television, and you got CNN, and there you see a guy far richer, far better, far more powerful than you sitting in a cage. What's your natural reaction going to be? You don't want to sit in that cage yourself. So one by one by one, these men went back to Russia, and they organized a meeting with Vladimir Putin and said, "Vladimir, what do we have to do to make sure we don't sit in a cage?" And he said, "It's very straightforward, 50%. Not 50% for the Russian government, and not 50% for the presidential administration of Russia, but 50% for Vladimir Putin." Now, when I say that, people have wrinkled their noses at me and said, "How do you know? How can you prove that?" And early on, when I was saying that in particular, people were skeptical. But it's now effectively been written up. If you go to the U.S. Treasury's website on their sanctions justification for Ukraine, you can see them specifically saying that in the names in the cases of certain Russian oligarchs. This is not made up stuff. So as a result, Putin becomes the richest man in the world, and he no longer is enemies with the oligarchs, he's business partners with the oligarchs. And I'm still doing my thing. I'm still doing research into how they do the stealing and exposing them, but this time I'm not going after Putin's enemies anymore, I'm going after Putin's 50% financial interest. Well, as you can imagine, this didn't last very long. And in November of 2005, I'd been living in Russia for 10 years at this point. I was flying back from London to Moscow. I arrive at Sheremetyevo 2 airport. I go to the VIP lounge, which should have been a 2-minute exercise. And an hour later, I'm still not being processed. I'm starting to get agitated and irritated that I'm still sitting at the airport. And just as I'm starting to raise my voice, four uniformed guards come into the VIP lounge, grab me, frog march me down to the detention center of the airport, and then lock me up. And at this point, I don't know whether I've been locked up because I'm going to jail, or I've been locked up because they're planning to deport me. And so I'm sitting there overnight, and as the night goes on, more and more people enter this detention area, some pretty shady characters for the most part. And I know that there's a flight out to London at 11 o'clock in the morning. And so I figure if I'm going to be deported, they're going to have me on that 11 o'clock flight. So I'm sitting there, can't get any sleep because it's just all too upsetting. Finally, the morning comes around, and at about 9:30 in the morning, I figure if I'm being deported, they're going to come and get me now because you need some time to process the whole thing. And so I bang on the door to try to get their attention. And when you're a prisoner in Russia, you no longer are a person, and they just ignore you. And they ignored me. And so I'm getting a little worried because, you know, the flight's leaving in an hour and a half. At 10 o'clock, I'm getting a bit more worried. I'm banging on the door again, and they're ignoring me some more. And I'm thinking, this is cutting it pretty tight. You know, an hour to get me fully processed, that's not enough time. At 10:30, they still haven't come and gotten me, and I'm thinking that I'm going to be arrested. I've been arrested. I'm sitting there at 10:30. I'm getting more and more worried. My adrenaline is starting to pump through my veins. 10:40, they still haven't come for me, and at this point, I'm really getting almost hysterical. 10:45, I'm in a full state of panic because the 15 minutes, there's no way they can get me onto that plane. Finally, at 10:47. The four guards, or different guards, because it was the night before, four guards come and get me, grab all my stuff, and then frog march me to the Aeroflot plane that's waiting on the tarmac. I'm the last person on the plane. And it was the biggest relief I've ever had in my life, knowing that I'm not going to jail in Russia. I was absolutely relieved. I gratefully ate the Aeroflot meal, which... I land in London, and then I discover that the Russian government, we make some official requests, and the Russian government responds to the official requests, and the reason I've been expelled from the country is they've declared me a threat to national security. well, that's pretty horrible. It's not great for my business. But I understand that when the Russians turn on you, they don't tend to do so mildly. They do so with extreme prejudice. And if they're kicking me out, that's just the beginning. There's a lot more bad stuff to come. And so I looked around at my situation. I said, what do I have that they could, where am I exposed? And there's two places I was exposed. I was exposed with people. I had a whole bunch of people on the ground there. And I'm exposed with our money. We have I was the largest foreign investor in the country. We have all of our assets there. And so I began an emergency evacuation of my people. And then we quickly and quietly sold every last share in the country and move every last dollar out of the country. And so by the time we're done, we had gotten everybody and everything out. Now, people often ask me, how is it possible, if they're such an evil regime, that they allowed you to do that? And the answer is that Putin's regime is evil, but they have really low caliber people working for them. And they're very bad at executing their evil. And so I was able to get all the stuff out. And so I was really happy. I got everybody out, got everything out. I dusted off my hands. I set up a new investment fund for other parts of the world. We had other places to conquer, focusing on other stuff. It was a shame what happened in Russia. Maybe I'll write a book about that someday. End of story. Well, while I was busy being done with Russia, they were just getting started with me. And the one thing I had still left in Russia was an office. I prepaid rent for an office. I kept an office there, and I had one secretary who sat there in case one day that the whole thing blew over. On the 4th of June, 2007, 18 months after I was expelled, 25 police officers raided my office in Moscow, looking for the stamps, seals, and certificates for our investment holding companies. When they didn't find them at our office, they then raided, another 25 officers raided the office of an American law firm that I used, where we did have those documents. So they raid the office of our law firm, they seize the documents, one of the young lawyers protests that they don't have the right to do that. They take him into a conference room and beat him to a pulp, and he was hospitalized afterwards. And they seize all these documents. I didn't know what they were going to do with the documents. I was a bit worried. And then I discovered what they were going to do with the documents, which was 3 months later, we discovered that we no longer owned our investment holding companies, which were empty at this point because we had taken all of our money out. We no longer owned our investment holding companies. The documents seized by the police had been used to fraudulently re-register those companies out of our name into the name of a man who had been convicted of murder and let out of jail early by the police. Now, I didn't have any economic stake in this whole thing because all of our money was out. But I had a huge legal stake in this whole thing. If the police were busy cooperating and colluding with murderers to steal companies, God knows what else they could do, and we couldn't allow this to carry on. So I go out and hire the smartest lawyer I knew in Russia, a young man named Sergei Magnitsky. He was 35 years old. He worked for an American law firm, and he was the kind of lawyer that could do 10 things in the time it took others to do one. He would just run circles around everybody else. And I hire Sergei Magnitsky to investigate what the purpose of this whole thing was and stop it for me. And so Sergei goes out and spends a number of months investigating, and he comes back and he said, I've discovered the whole scheme. There were two basic objectives. The first objective was to steal all of your money. And they went to all of your banks with search warrants looking for your money, but they couldn't find any because you got it out. And so I felt happy about that I had beaten them to the punch. He said the second objective, however, they did succeed at. And the second objective had to do with our taxes. And when I was selling everything, when I was liquidating all of our holdings to get out of Russia, we ended up declaring a profit of $1 billion. And we paid a capital gains tax bill of $230 million. So what the bad guys did, which Sergei discovered, was 2 days before Christmas in 2007, they went to the tax authorities and they said there was a mistake made in the previous year's tax filing. These companies didn't make $1 billion, they made zero. And they came up with some concocted paperwork for this statement. And therefore, because they made zero, the $230 million that was paid in taxes last year was paid in error. And they said, therefore, we would like to have a tax refund of $230 million. It was the largest tax refund in the history of Russia. They applied for it 2 days before Christmas in 2007, and it was approved and paid out the next day, one on Christmas Eve. We were absolutely astounded by this whole thing, and I had always assumed that Putin was a nationalist. He might be a bad guy, he might be a liar, he might be all sorts of terrible things, but I always assumed that he was, you know, working in the national interest of Russia. That was always my assumption. And therefore, if he's a nationalist, he couldn't allow a bunch of corrupt officials to steal $230 million, not from me, it was from his own government, taxes. And so we decided to put together criminal complaints we fired with every different law enforcement agency in Russia. I went to the newspapers and went to the New York Times and the main business newspaper, Vedomosti in Moscow, and told them the whole story. And then Sergei went and actually went to the Russian State Investigative Committee and testified against the police officers. And we waited for the good guys to get the bad guys. What we soon discovered is that in the Putin regime, there are no good guys, just bad guys. Instead of going after the people who stole the money, about a month after Sergei testified against these police officers, the same police officers he testified against came to his home at 8 a.m. in front of his wife and two children, arrested him, put him in pretrial detention, and then began to torture him to withdraw his testimony. They put him in cells with 14 inmates and 8 beds and left the lights on 24 hours a day to impose sleep deprivation. They put him in cells with no heat and no window panes in December in Moscow, so he nearly froze to death. They put him in cells with no toilet, just a hole in the floor where the sewage would bubble up. They'd move him from cell to cell to cell in the middle of the night. And the purpose of all this was to get him to withdraw his testimony against the police officers, and they wanted to get him to sign a false confession to say that he stole the $230 million, and he did so on my instruction. Now, nobody knows how they would behave in a situation like this. I don't know how I would behave. If you had asked Sergei before he had gone into prison what he would have done, he probably couldn't have told you. But when Sergei was faced with this terrible Faustian bargain, for him, the moral pain of bearing false witness and perjuring himself was greater than the physical pain that they were putting him under, and he refused to buckle. And they had never had this before. Everybody buckles with these people. They always buckled. And it was a very inconvenient situation for them. And because they didn't know what to do with Sergei. And so they just kept on ratcheting it up. And it got worse and worse. And after about 6 months, Sergei started to get terrible pains in his stomach. He ended up having lost 20 kilos. And when he went to the doctor, he was diagnosed as having pancreatitis and gallstones and needing an operation, which was scheduled for the 1st of August, 2009. About a week before the operation, they came to him again, asked him to sign a false confession. Again, he refused. And so in retaliation for him refusing, they then abruptly moved him from a prison that had a medical facility to a maximum security prison called Butyrka, which is considered to be one of the worst prisons in Russia, a medieval prison. And most significantly for Sergei, there was no medical facilities there. And at Butyrka, his health completely broke down. He went into a downward spiral. He went into sort of constant ear-piercing pain, which they refused to treat. He and his lawyers wrote more than 20 different requests, desperate requests for medical attention, to every different branch of the criminal justice system of Russia. And every one of those requests was either ignored or denied. And finally, his body could no longer take it. And on the night of November 16, 2009, Sergei Magnitsky went into critical condition. The authorities at Butyrka didn't want to have responsibility for Sergei dying there. And so they put him in an ambulance and moved him to another prison facility that had a medical wing called Matryoshka Tishina. But when he arrived at Matryoshka Tishina, they didn't put him in the emergency room. They put him in an isolation cell. They chained him to a bed, and 8 riot guards with rubber batons came into that cell and beat him for 1 hour and 18 minutes to death. That was November 16th, 2009, 6 years ago. He left a wife and 2 children. I got that news at 7:45 a.m. on the 17th of November here in London, here in England. And that was by far the most traumatic, horrible, life-changing news I could have ever gotten. Sergei Magnitsky he wasn't someone who worked for me, who got hit by a car by accident or, you know, fell ill of some natural causes. He was plucked out of his middle-class life. He bought a Starbucks coffee in the morning and sat in his cubicle in an American law firm, working for me, put into the worst hellhole in Russia, and killed at the age of 37, slowly and sadistically. And had he not worked for me, he wouldn't be dead. And so for me, I took it extremely personally, and I took great responsibility for what happened to him. And I decided that I could not go through my life and not do anything and everything possible to make sure that the people who killed him face justice. And for the last 6 years, that's what I've been trying to do. Now, one of the reasons that we know about his prison conditions is because Sergei wrote it all down. He wrote 450 complaints in his 358 days in detention, documenting everything that happened to him. And strangely, the Russians allowed him to write these complaints. They're slavishly procedural. He could write the complaints and file them, and then they could just ignore them or reject them. But as a result of him writing these complaints, and he'd write out a complaint a day or sometimes 2 a day, and he'd hand his lawyer a stack of these complaints. His lawyer would file them once a month. We would get copies of them. Because we have copies of them, we ended up with the most well-documented human rights abuse case that's come out of Russia in the last 35 years. And because of that, we figured that no matter how corrupt the Putin regime is, this is just a major international stain on Russia. This case was now all over the press. We figured they had to at least throw some of the mid-level people under the bus. But they didn't. Putin personally got involved in this aftermath, and they changed the narrative completely. They said that Sergei Magnitsky died of natural causes. He had never been sick in prison. He never had uncovered a fraud, and that there was nobody in the Russian government that bore any responsibility for his death. And they went on to give special promotions and state honors to some of the people who were most complicit in this crime. The only 2 people who have ever been prosecuted in this whole sordid affair was 3 years after they murdered Sergei Magnitsky. They put him on trial in the first ever trial against a dead man in the history of Russia. And they put me on trial as his co-defendant. And there was a courtroom in Moscow for several months in 2013 where there was prosecuting lawyers, defense lawyers, judges, clerks, bailiffs, audiences, press, and 2 empty seats in the cage where they had this spectacle. And they found us both guilty. They couldn't do anything more to Sergei since they had already killed him. They found me, they sentenced me to 9 years in absentia in Russia. So the Russian government was clearly not going to bring us any justice. So we said to ourselves, we can't get any justice inside of Russia. Let's get justice outside of Russia. And so I started traveling the world trying to figure out where we could get justice outside of Russia. Maybe the International Criminal Court. No, that's only for genocide. Maybe universal jurisdiction. This is a legal term that some countries have. I went to the countries that had universal jurisdiction, and they don't really do it. Then I said, well, let's talk to governments. I went to the United States government, and the best thing that they could offer is that the State Department could put in 2 lines in their annual human rights report to condemn the murder of Sergei Magnitsky. And so it became clear that there were no concepts of international justice. If something like this happens, there was nothing I could do. But I was so heartbroken.
Sorry to interrupt you, but you've got another 15 minutes. Maybe okay.
I'm done in 2 minutes. So we came up with an idea, which was, if there is no concept of justice, let's create our own. And so I said, what was this crime all about? This crime was all about the theft of $230 million. And the people who stole this money don't like to keep their money in Russia. And so we came up with this concept, which was they like to keep their money in the West, in New York and London and Geneva, and they like to send their kids to boarding school. So let's not allow them to travel, and let's not allow them to spend that money. And I went and took this idea to Washington, and I shared it with Senator John McCain, a Republican, and Senator Benjamin Cardin, a Democrat. And they loved the idea, and they introduced the Sergei Magnitsky Act, which imposes visa sanctions and asset freezes on the people who killed him and the people who do similar atrocities in Russia. And it was such a popular idea that in November of 2012, the Senate voted 92-4 in favor of it. The House of Representatives voted 89% in favor of it. And on the 14th of December 2012, President Obama signed it into law. There are now 32 people on the Magnitsky list who are on the U.S. federal OFAC sanctions list, which means that any bank in the world will effectively get in trouble if they do business with them. They can't do any banking business. Many countries, including America, have canceled their visas. And most significantly, when the regime falls in Russia, which it will eventually do, and they apply and they rush for asylum in the West, they're going to type their names into the computer and say, wait a second, you were on the Magnitsky list. You're a human rights violator. No, we're not going to give you asylum. We're going to send you back to Russia. And that's the scariest thing of all for these bad guys, to know that there's no place that they can go when it's all over. We'll never be able to bring Sergei Magnitsky back, but at least his name is on a law which creates a legacy for him, which might prevent other similar atrocities from happening, because there's now consequences for doing what they did to him and what they might do to others. Thank you very much.